you all for coming. We've had a great tour through the upstate New York region. This is our, unfortunately, our last stop. You were very kind, too, in terms of the weather today. Pretty spectacular for this time of year. What I want to do today is talk a bit about national and regional economic conditions and how the Federal Reserve is responding to them, paying particular attention to the housing sector and conditions here in upstate New York. As always, what I have to say reflects my own views and not necessarily those of the Federal Open Market Committee or the Federal Reserve System. As many of you, as you know, this is my first chance to speak at the University of Buffalo since I became president of the New York Fed. So by way of introduction, I thought I'd start with a little bit of a description of what the New York Fed does and what makes my job so interesting. The New York Federal Reserve is part of the Federal Reserve System, which is America's central bank. It was established by Congress in 1913, so we're 3 years away from our centennial. With this act, Congress delegated to the Federal Reserve its constitutional authority to manage the money supply and designed it to be decentralized, to be representative of all, the entire United States and independent of the political process. The Federal Reserve System is comprised of the Board of Governors in Washington, D.C. That's the federal agency led by Chairman Ben Bernanke, plus 12 relatively autonomous reserve banks that span the country. For example, the district overseen by the New York Federal Reserve includes all of New York State, the 12 northern counties of New Jersey, Fairfield County, Connecticut, and last but not least, Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands. Always a good thing, always a good place to visit in the winter. Each reserve bank is autonomous with its own charter and board of directors drawn from its district, but we are overseen by the Board of Governors in Washington. The law that created the Federal Reserve System made us independent so we can make decisions in the national interest free from political pressure. However, the Fed is accountable to Congress. Congress has set an explicit objective for us in terms of how we conduct monetary policy to pursue the highest level of employment consistent with price stability. This objective is also often referred to as our dual mandate because it combines two goals, high employment and low and stable inflation. In order to promote these objectives, we also pay close attention to financial stability, because without financial stability, it's very hard to achieve our goals for jobs and inflation. The Federal Open Market Committee meets in Washington 8 times per year to deliberate and vote on monetary policy. Our next meeting is Tuesday and Wednesday of next week. As the New York Fed president, I'm vice chair, and one of the good things about being the vice chairman is I get a permanent vote on the committee. At these meetings, the 12 Federal Reserve Bank presidents and the seven, right now there's only six members of the Board of Governors, discuss the outlook for the economy and decide what they want to do in terms of monetary policy. To reach these assessments, we augment input from our research departments with critical information about local economic conditions that we draw from our board of directors, regional advisory councils, and conversations with local stakeholders. You may know that one of my councils, the Upstate New York Regional Advisory Board, is designed specifically to provide us with timely information from this area. In this way, the decisions of the Federal Open Market Committee are continually informed by views gathered from all parts of the country, including upstate New York. One thing that makes my job even more interesting is that the New York Fed has some roles that are unique within the Federal Reserve System. So I thought I would tell you a little bit about that. We alone implement monetary policy. So if the Federal Open Market Committee decides that they want something to happen on the monetary policy front, they instruct New York to carry it out. We're the operational arm of the Federal Reserve Board with respect to the conduct of monetary policy. To implement monetary policy, we buy and sell Treasury securities. We're also the eyes and ears of the Federal Reserve on Wall Street, and we supervise some of the largest financial institutions in the country and the world. We operate FedWire. This is a payment system that allows banks to implement payments in real time between each other. And we provide quite a few banking services for the U.S. Treasury. For example, we conduct the Treasury auctions that the Treasury uses to fund the federal debt. We also offer lots of services for central banks and governments around the world. For example, deep in the bowels of the Federal Reserve, there's the Federal Reserve Gold Vault, which is the largest repository of gold in the world. Unfortunately, it's not our gold, it's foreign central bank gold. And if you actually come by the New York Fed, you can take a tour of the Gold Vault, which is actually very interesting, and I encourage you to do that. Finally, as I mentioned earlier, we have a pretty diverse district compared to some of the other Federal Reserve banks. You know, we have Manhattan, which is pretty dense, ranging all the way to upstate New York, which at times is quite sparse, and the Caribbean islands of Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands. So even in normal times, there's plenty to keep us busy, but in the last few years, it's been even a little bit busier than usual. So let me talk a little bit about the last couple of years, the crisis, and our response. As you know, these are not normal times. The financial crisis that broke in mid-2007 and intensified dramatically following the failure of Lehman Brothers really was the worst financial crisis the United States has experienced since the Great Depression. And that crisis in the financial markets was followed by one of the longest and deepest recessions that we've had since World War II, so much so that people are now referring to it as the Great Recession. The Federal Reserve responded aggressively and I think very creatively in an effort to pursue our dual mandate. And our actions in response to the crisis fell into two broad buckets. First, we took steps to supply liquidity to the financial system so that financial markets could continue to function properly in order to enable households and businesses to maintain their ability to obtain credit. Carrying out an age-old central banking role, we loaned funds to financial firms secured by their high-quality collateral. Traditionally, such loans had only been made to depository institutions such as banks, but in the U.S., in the modern U.S. financial system, there are many other lenders that are not banks. These companies and markets provide vital financing for credit card loans, short-term business needs, and many other activities. During the crisis, the ability of these non-banks to continue to fund credit became impaired. Fortunately, many years ago, Congress gave the Federal Reserve emergency authority to lend to non-banks in what's called, quote, unusual and exigent circumstances. Well, during the crisis, we were in unusual and exigent circumstances. So we used this authority to lend to a wide variety of financial firms and markets. In fact, a handful of times we had to make particularly difficult decisions with respect to making emergency loans to prevent the disorderly failure of individual firms. We did not do this because we wanted to help those firms per se, but because allowing them to collapse in a disorderly fashion in the midst of a financial crisis would have had done grave harm to the U.S. economy and to households and businesses throughout the United States. In all the actions that we took, the Federal Reserve's loans were collateralized, and we are very confident that we'll be repaid in full. In the second bucket, we took aggressive steps to ease monetary policy in order to support economic activity and employment. By the end of 2008, we reduced the short-term interest rates that we directly control to virtually zero, the lowest level of short-term rates in the history of the Federal Reserve. Given that the economy was still weak, we went a bit further. In order to provide still further support to the economy, we bought more than $1.5 trillion of long-term assets, principally mortgage bonds guaranteed by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac that are supported by the U.S. Treasury. When the Fed buys long-term assets, it pushes down long-term interest rates. This actually provides support to economic activity because it makes housing more affordable. It supports consumptions because households can now refinance their mortgage at lower interest rates. In addition, lower long-term mortgage rates reduce the cost of capital for businesses, and this encourages them to hire more and invest more, and that actually lends support to the economy. So where are we today in terms of the national economy and the outlook? So let me start my discussion with a few comments about national economic conditions. As I discussed in a recent speech, the Great Recession has been followed by a tepid recovery. Since June 2009, economic activity has grown, but not robustly. In recent months, in fact, the momentum has slowed. After rising at about a 3.25% annual rate during the second half of 2009, real GDP growth grew more slowly in the first half of 2010. And we expect that when we get the third quarter GDP numbers later this week, we'll see growth plus or minus 2% or so, with demand growth only barely keeping pace with firms' ability to increase their productivity. The rate of growth has not been sufficient to generate much in the way of employment gains. And so as a consequence, the unemployment rate remains stubbornly high currently today at 9.6%. And as is typical in such circumstances in which we have lots of unemployment, there's lots of slack in the economy, and as a consequence of that slack, the rate of inflation has declined. So the question is, why are we experiencing this soft patch now? Why has the economy slowed? Well, I think there's several reasons for this. In the first year, this recovery, as is typical, benefited from firms replenishing their inventories. During the recession, inventories were drawn down sharply, and as the recovery started to take hold, businesses felt a little bit more confident, began to replenish their inventories. Unfortunately, this effect has mostly run its course, and so the benefits of that are now petering out. Second, the growth impulse from the 2000 fiscal stimulus package, still positive, but not as powerful as it was before. And third, the U.S. usual handoff that we see from inventory-led growth to private final demand-led growth has not yet been fully established. Instead, we have ongoing sluggishness in two key sectors that typically have led past recoveries, consumer spending and housing. The slow recovery of consumer spending and housing in the face of very substantial monetary and policy and fiscal policy stimulus reflects the painful unwinding of the dynamics at work that happened during the expansion that preceded the Great Recession. Beginning around 2003, underwriting standards for residential mortgages were significantly relaxed, and that led to a sharp rise in household borrowing and in home prices. The rise in home prices helped to support more borrowing as households used lines of credit and second mortgages to tap into their rising home equity. This also fueled a strong boom in home construction. The increased demand for houses drove up home prices, but these home price increases could not be sustained without limit. When home prices eventually peaked and started to turn down, the somewhat shoddy underwriting practices were revealed, and the dynamic linking home prices, credit, and consumption went into reverse, and the home price boom turned into a bust. So let's consider first what this means for consumption. Consumption of goods and services rose at about a 2% annual rate during the first half of 2010, and we're not seeing much signs of a strengthening in the third quarter. Several factors are inhibiting families from spending. These include job and income losses, low levels of confidence, declines in wealth as real estate and stock prices have dipped. Households are saving more and paying down their debts. And of course, lenders have tended to reinforce this with tightening underwriting standards for credit relative to what we saw pre-recession. The question that's critical here is, have households completed their deleveraging so they will soon spend more, or does the process have further to go? Although we believe that substantial progress has been made in this deleveraging process, it's hard to tell whether this has run its course. Now let's consider why housing market activity, both new constructions and sales, remains depressed. One reason for this is that many existing homes stand vacant. We estimate that there are roughly 3 million vacant housing units more than usual. This stock of vacant homes will shrink when the foreclosure pipeline empties and more of these empty homes are rented out or sold. On the sales side, even though low mortgage rates are unusually low and house prices, because they have fallen, have boosted housing affordability to the highest level in 40 years, the current pace of sales remains very sluggish. Impediments to home sales include tight lending standards, a weak job market, and continued uncertainty about the future trajectory of home prices. One important factor is the fact that the large drop in home prices between 2006 and 2009 has reduced the amount of equity that households have in their homes. This makes it more difficult for homeowners to trade up and move into better homes. And in fact, for many families, the mortgages they hold today are worth more than their homes are worth. This means that they cannot easily refinance their mortgages or sell their homes if they need to, if they experience a crisis such as job loss or serious illness. On the foreclosure side, foreclosure completions, so the end of the foreclosure process, are at an all-time high. That's the bad news. The good news is that the initiation of new foreclosures may finally be starting to slow. Recently, there's been a lot of attention focused on cases where some of the documentation used in the foreclosure process may have been flawed. The Fed actively encourages efforts to find viable alternatives to foreclosure. Not many people know this, but we have a team of New York Fed officials that work with mortgage counselors and community activists to support distressed homeowners. And our lawyers support legal aid programs for people facing foreclosure. At the same time, we have to recognize that it is important that foreclosures that do comply with the law can ultimately take place. This is a necessary part of returning the housing market to more normal conditions. Along with two other agencies, the Fed is reviewing the foreclosure practices at the major bank mortgage servicers. We're also keeping an eye on banks' potential liabilities where they made representations about the mortgages bought by investors that may not have been correct in all cases. We want to ensure that the housing finance business is supported by robust back office operations. That means for processing new mortgages as well as for foreclosures, so that home buyers and investors have full confidence in the process. We are monitoring developments very closely in this area in order to evaluate the potential impact on housing, on financial markets, and on the overall economy. Now let me turn to economic conditions in upstate New York. It's no secret that this region has struggled with weak economic growth and population loss in recent decades. The region has experienced some very painful economic restructuring, particularly as it's lost many of its high-paying manufacturing jobs over the years. The good news, though, is that this process has yielded, finally, a more productive and more diversified economy with a much larger service sector than before. For this and other reasons I will discuss, upstate New York economy has actually weathered the Great Recession relatively well compared to the rest of the country. While the upstate economy generally underperformed the nation during the 1980s and 1990s, its recent experience has been quite different. While things aren't good here in absolute terms, the Great Recession began in upstate New York later than it did for the United States as a whole, and job losses were actually less severe than for the nation as a whole. The relatively strong economic performance of the region of late is also clearly tied to its stable housing market. Upstate New York's relatively slow economic performance and the lack of population growth during the expansion of the 2000s supported only modest increases in home prices and sales during the housing boom. So as a consequence of that, when home prices and sales began to decline quite rapidly in many parts of the nation, they were relatively steady across this region. As a result, upstate New York has been largely spared the boom and bust cycle in housing that occurred in many other parts of the United States. In fact, many of the upstate New York's metropolitan areas even experienced home price appreciation during the housing bust, making these places among the best performing in the country during this period. Many parts of the country experienced sharp housing bust with sharp drops in housing-related activity, such as construction and purchases of major appliances. For example, in fast-growing places such as California and Florida, construction jobs grew to be a very large share of employment. That was good news during the boom, but during the bust, a large number of these jobs were lost during the subsequent recession. This dynamic did not take place in places like Buffalo, while the housing sector was very small to begin with, and thus there were very few jobs to lose during the housing bust. Another important part of the story is that homeowners in upstate New York did not take on as much debt, and households here are less strained than they are elsewhere. One reason for this, of course, is that home prices did not appreciate rapidly here, so homes remain relatively affordable. Moreover, there was generally much lower penetration of risky non-prime mortgages into this region's housing markets. So upstate New York's home loans have generally performed better than elsewhere in the country, with fewer delinquencies and foreclosures. Indeed, much of the region was spared the worst effects of the subprime mortgage boom and bust. Thus, compared with other parts of the nation, the upstate economy has performed relatively well over the past few years. As a large and growing sector, local colleges and universities are part of this story, and they've surely contributed to the region's economic stability over the past few years. Indeed, the University of Buffalo provides a clear example of how a university can play a key role in its local economy. The benefits of the higher education, though, go well beyond their direct economic contributions, such as employment and spending. For a very important reason, these activities can increase the region's stock of human capital. That is, the total supply of knowledge and skills in the workforce. A region's human capital contributes to its economic success and resiliency. The educational activities of a region's colleges and universities help build the skills of the local workforce. In addition, the knowledge created by colleges and universities through their research activities can play a key role in starting and supporting local businesses. Businesses can use university expertise, infrastructure, and research to help them develop cutting-edge products and services. Furthermore, universities often employ local businesses to develop and commercialize new products that arise from their research activities. This dynamic can expand local activity and consequently create new jobs for highly skilled workers in the region. Institutions such as the university here play a vital role in this sort in the upstate economy. The diversification of Buffalo's economy has helped the region to weather the Great Recession. In particular, major investments in the Buffalo Niagara Medical Campus have allowed healthcare and the education sectors to expand and become an increasingly important part of the local economy. These sectors provide stability because they're less susceptible to contraction during economic downturns compared to other parts of the economy. Moreover, the Buffalo's robust banking industry provides an additional source of strength. And the strong Canadian dollar is helped by attracting Canadian shoppers to shop over the border in the United States. This has bolstered retail sales, contributing to local economic stability over the past few years. So what is the Federal Reserve doing now in response to the economy? Since the beginning of the downturn, the Fed has actively used monetary policy and regulatory policy to help support economic activity, improve economic outcomes, both here in Buffalo and across the nation. And as a consequence, things have been better than what we would have gotten in the absence of such support. With regard to monetary policy, the Fed has in place a highly accommodative stance. The FOMC has said that it will keep short-term interest rates at exceptionally low levels for an extended period of time. The Fed also retains large amounts of mortgage-backed bonds acquired in order to support the housing market and to help bring down mortgage and other long-term interest rates to the historically low levels in place today. The Federal Open Market Committee and the chairman have stated their commitment to take further actions to bring interest rates down further should economic conditions warrant. In a recent speech, I said that both the current levels of unemployment and inflation and the time frame over which they are likely to return to levels consistent with our mandate are unacceptable. I said that I thought further Fed action was likely to be warranted unless the economic outlook were to evolve in a way that made me more confident that we would see better outcomes for both employment and inflation before too long. Turning to regulatory policy, the biggest lesson of the financial crisis is that severe financial disruptions can inflict very large and persistent costs on people's lives and jobs. Over the past year, with Fed leadership and support, important new regulatory initiatives have been advanced to create a global financial system where players cannot slide back into risky business as usual, the type of behavior that generated the crisis in the first place. These include the recent agreement with international bank regulators, sometimes referred to as Basel III, to impose stricter capital and liquidity standards for globally active banks, and the considerable regulatory changes embodied in the Dodd-Frank Act, which was passed by the U.S. Congress to reform the U.S. financial system. These measures recognize that to avert or contain future financial crises, we need a financial system that can withstand large negative shocks. First, market participants must not have the incentive to take on excessive risk. Instead, incentives should reward actions that support economic growth and financial stability. And financial firms must set aside enough capital and liquidity so that when things go wrong, they can absorb the losses with their own resources. Finally, if these buffers prove to be inadequate and if a financial firm does veer towards failure, the official sector needs the tools in place to wind them down in an orderly manner without having to make the terrible choice between a chaotic failure that would devastate the entire economy versus a taxpayer-funded rescue. In conclusion, I have to say I've really enjoyed my past few days traveling through upstate New York. It's been a real privilege to talk to all of you about how my job at the Federal Reserve affects your lives and what's going on in your lives and how we can take that into consideration in terms of how we conduct monetary policy and regulatory policy. The links, I think, are many. First, how the Fed's dual mandate for full employment and stable prices guides our actions and affects your lives. How we rely on understanding economic conditions in your in this region as an input for how we formulate our policies. And how our efforts to restore financial stability have provided a more solid foundation for lending to households and businesses, including small businesses. To summarize, conditions at the moment, after a recession that was milder in upstate New York than in many parts of the country, the region is showing signs of a modest recovery. A more diversified, more knowledge-based economy and a relatively small housing sector help limit the recession's impact on many communities in this region. Nevertheless, the Great Recession did spread much pain throughout this region, and unemployment remains much higher than we would like. The Fed cannot wave a magic wand and make the problems remaining from the preceding period of excess vanish immediately. But we can provide essential support for the needed adjustments. Even with our best efforts, the road to recovery here in upstate New York and elsewhere is likely to be long and bumpy. But I am confident that we will make it. In the dynamicism that is represented in this room, the private sector combined with academic learning and research, I'm very confident this will provide a strong underpinning for future prosperity. I thank you very much for coming here today, for your very kind attention, and I will be happy to take a few questions.
Thank you. I was wondering, I know you mentioned a lot about housing, and I know now healthcare is a big thing, and I know a lot of people are saying that that's where employment is. And I know a lot of the specialty medications are rising at increasing rates. So is there going to be regulation for healthcare as well? Like, I know, like, since it's providing a lot of the jobs, so, like, are you guys thinking ahead of that?
Okay. Before I answer that question, I just want to give you some ground rules for the questions today. We have a Federal Open Market Committee next week, and so as a consequence of that, the rules of the road are I'm not supposed to talk at all about monetary policy or the real economy. So if you want to talk, so it's a national economy. So if you could put your questions in the lane of regional economic conditions and regulatory and financial reform, those questions I have no constraints. But if you ask me about monetary policy and national economic conditions, I'm going to have to shy away from those questions. Now, turning to your question on healthcare, this is something that's pretty far away from the Fed's dual mandate of full employment and price stability. But, you know, there's a lot of questions that have been raised by healthcare reform in terms of how healthcare reform is going to be implemented. Obviously, this is, you know, hugely important for the country. Healthcare represents a very significant share of GDP. And so how healthcare reform is implemented and carried out, I think, is going to have some significant effects for economic performance over the next few years. I think it's really too early to answer that question of how that's going to go on any sort of definitive basis. It is certainly one thing that we hear about from the business community, quite a bit of uncertainty about what healthcare means for them. And that uncertainty, you know, is probably a factor that is, you know, one of the reasons that are, in, you know, it causing people to be a little bit more cautious in terms of their behavior.
Question from this side? Over here. Did we have a question here? Question up at the top here, I think, or Suzanne?
Good afternoon. Are the separate Federal Reserve banks able to address the variations in employment in regions across the country, or is there a uniform policy?
Well, I think the way I would frame it is the Federal Reserve banks all are very focused on economic conditions in their region so that they can share that with the other Federal Reserve Bank presidents and the members of the Board of Governors so that everybody has a pretty good picture of what's going on in the entire nation. Now, once that information is shared, in my opinion, monetary policy is based on what's best for the country. It would be very hard to have the 12 Federal Reserve Bank presidents go in the meeting and just base it on what's happening in their little region, because then there would be a lot of disagreement. It would be very, very hard to reach a consensus. So the information is shared. a national picture is assembled. And I think that it's fair to say that the Federal Reserve Bank presidents and the Board of Governors make policy based on what they think is best for the country as a whole.
Another question? Bill, I think there's a question up top, too.
Okay.
Thank you.
Oel Halbreich, I'm professor in UB and the chair of the WPA section on interdisciplinary collaboration, which we try to put people together, and we try to do things. And I would like to follow up on what you just described. My understanding is that there is a shared information and gathering of information from different regions of your constituency. The question is simple. What actually can the New York Federal Reserve Bank do, perform? Western New York.
Well, we do a number of things. One thing that we do is we actually provide a lot of information about what's going on in the regional economy. Every quarter, we have a regional economic briefing where we share a lot of information that we've assembled with reporters and in the region to try to shine a flashlight on what some of the key issues are in the region. For example, so last week we had a regional economic briefing where we really focused on housing and what was different and the same about housing in upstate New York, New York City, compared to the rest of the country. Another thing we do is we do a lot of community outreach. That means working with community activists in the region. We do work on financial literacy, education. It's very, very important for us to be, to stay well connected to the region. The reason why we spent the last 3 days here is because that's very, very important. That really provides the legitimacy for the Federal Reserve, I think, as an institution. That's really why the Federal Reserve has a lot of support nationally. So I think it's, hugely important that we stay in touch with the region. We need to offer value added back to you. We work very hard to do that, and we're always talking to people about what other things might be advantageous, that in other words, where we have a comparative advantage, where we could be helpful in supporting activity in the region.
We'll take one more question from above.
Bob Kosubaki. Does the Fed expect that the unfunded pension obligations of local and state governments to have a drag on the economy, either regionally or as a whole in the future?
The question is, do we think the unfunded pension liabilities of state and local governments will have a drag on the economy immediately or in the future? Well, I think the answer is, of course, those unfunded pension liabilities at some point will have to be funded. Now, they can be funded by increased contributions, or they can be funded by changing the terms and conditions of those pension commitments. So it's not really clear exactly when this might take place, how it will take place, and how significant the constraint will be from those decisions. I don't think that we should expect anything that's dramatic in the near term. The pension liabilities took a long time to build up, and it's probably going to take a long time to sort of work down those unfunded pension liabilities. So I think this is a long-run process rather than a short-run process.
Thank you very much for your questions.